Then I hear it, and he hears it, the heavy whomp of a siren. The light from a police car shines brightly against us, and a metallic voice booms a tinny instruction. Step away from the woman and put your hands in the air. I can't see fully into the light, but I know there are people there behind the open doors, crouching low for protection. Nehru steps away from me with his hands held high. There's so much space between us now. My hands reach out across the space. Then he hears it. And I can just hear it, but the person behind the lights can't hear it because of the noise from the club, and the noise from the street drowns out the sati melody that says someone is calling you. He reaches reflexively, and they reach reflexively, and he hears it as I hear it, but he feels it, and I don't. He lies there in my father's shirt, limbs askew, sneakers still pristine white, as his black blood pools in potholes and his hands slap against the ground. You're safe, a voice tells me. He can't hurt you. Don't look. It's all over, it says. Shots fired, shots fired, requesting ambulance to alley between S and T streets for suspect down. I feel cold. I become a series of shivers. Then I can't feel myself, even as all the pizza and the beer and whatever else frat boy decided we were drinking erupts from my mouth onto the pavement before me. I have no words now, only piercing sounds. Chapter 3. Mom is already awake when I come downstairs in my spandex shorts and sports bra. She stands in the center of the room, surrounded by boxes, holding an old book in one hand and her glasses in the other. Oh, hi, sweetie, she says when she looks up. Dad and I didn't want to wake you. You were just passed out on your covers. Her eyes drop to the silver bar in my belly button, and her jaw tightens. I pierced it the summer before my senior year of high school, and it has been a sore point ever since. Mom can't articulate why she doesn't like it, and I can't say why her discomfort pleases me so much, but we have learned to live with each other. You're up early, I say. She spreads her arms wide to the room and says, so much to pack up, so little time. I thought that's what you pay movers for. They can't decide what you take with you, what you put in storage, and what you throw away, she says. She folds her hands over her stomach. Her ring catches the light while her glasses hang loose from her fingers. She has more splotches on her arms and more wrinkles now, despite the creams and cleansers she uses. Everyone says I look exactly like her when she was my age. The same large eyes, the same dark hair, the same skinny, long-legged frame. But we can't be more dissimilar. We are an experiment in nature versus nurture. She is from Texas. I am not. She has 5 siblings. I do not. She paid her way through college and law school. I did not. She is methodical. I am not. We used to snap at each other without end, criticizing and reacting until Dad made jokes about being Switzerland. Now we agree that distance is better for some relationships. Mom says, "You're sure it's not too cold outside? The mornings are still a little chilly." I'm going for a run. I know, but, Mom, I'll be fine. She opens her mouth and sighs. I can feel her eyes on me as I slip out of the front door and down the front steps. The streets are empty and quiet this early in the morning, and I can hear my own footsteps as they fall. I can never forget the imperfections in these brick sidewalks, where they rise and dip around tree roots, where loose segments can make you stumble and fall. Mom is right. The morning is cooler than I expected, but I am committed to the cold air sting that will soon turn to an unbearably soggy heat. Such is the way of a city built on a swamp. My boyfriend doesn't understand my obsession with running, and I can't explain to him why I take a pair of running shoes with me wherever I go. He used to pout when I told him that I like to run alone. He said, "You don't think I'm fast enough?" "No," I said, "but we ran through Central Park together all the same," and I purposely pushed the pace to prove my point. Abuse is what he has called it, and it wouldn't be too strong a term, but I crave the feel of burning air struggling up my throat, the feel of my heaving chest. I pay special attention to each breath. He understands now and settles for kisses before I leave and when I return, but he always wants more. He says he will train for the New York City Marathon this year. He wants me to run with him. In this section of the city, all the streets are corridors between pretty houses sloping towards the Potomac River. I peek into first-floor living rooms and kitchens and the lives just beginning at this time of day. That my parents are leaving, that they have sold their house, is all the more remarkable in a zip code where people cling to even the smallest property as their lifeline to relevance. It's a statement about how things have changed. This was once a city of possibility and hope. Now it's a society of fear, no matter how colorful its row house facades. I run to the sundial at the end of 30th Street and watch the river churning this early morning. I love the Georgetown waterfront in the summer, especially the mornings when the only other people here are die-hard runners hell-bent on exercise before work. I follow the water's edge as the sun rises over Mount St. Alban and flashes against the skyscrapers in Arlington on the Virginia Bank. I run past the empty outdoor tables at the Sequoia and the Washington Harbor, thankful for the quiet and the cool breeze off the silver-blue water. Farther up, the river gurgles and makes petty rapids against slick rocks where small sticks struggle to keep above a white froth. There is already traffic on the Whitehurst Freeway heading from Maryland into downtown. It provides a steady background hum to which I time my breathing. I can feel the breeze against my stomach and my thighs. My legs feel stiff and they tingle, but I push forward towards the C&O Canal. The first time we ran here, Niru and I made plans to meet halfway between our two houses. It was a weekday in June, the summer before senior year, long enough after the end of school that the novelty of boredom was wearing thin. "That's like more than 6 miles for each of us," I said. "You scared, slacker?" he texted me. I hated his taunts. He said, "You don't think you can make it, do you?" "Oh, I can make it." "Well, prove it." I ran faster than I should have through the streets to the crushed pebble path along the canal. At the ancient locks, water poured over carefully placed stones smoothed by centuries of flow. In the long stretches between, the water became stagnant and covered by a film of bright green algae. The sun that day was unrelenting. I wanted to stop, but I pushed because Niru wouldn't stop halfway, and he wouldn't let it go if he overran me. He was the perfect partner during track season, always pushing the pace, but making sure that his legs matched my legs stride for stride as he pulled me along by some invisible tether. I'd become a better runner because of our friendship, maybe even a better person. That was one of the things I'd written in the letter I'd planned to give him at graduation. But that never happened. As I ran farther into Maryland, I picked up speed and brushed by other runners, people in pairs or with animals on leashes, all moving at a slower pace. I could feel my legs grow tired, but I kept pushing, my steps timed and rhythmic. "I think up a song," Niru told me when I asked how he ran so steady, how he ignored the pain, "and I play it on repeat in my head until I can't think of anything else. Then I don't feel, and I'm free." "You tried," Niru said to me when I finally reached the halfway. He sat on a log by the path in the small shade of a scraggly tree. "Here, drink up," he said, and he gave me a bottle with water sloshing around a frozen ice core. "You ran here with this," I said. Of course he did. Sometimes being friends with Niru was annoying. His deliberateness and conscientiousness stood in such stark contrast to my impulsivity that I had to remind myself that we were actually the same age. That's when I realized I'd left the house without my keys. "Those who forget are often forgotten," Mom would say to me in the multiple text messages she used to send to make certain that one thing or another was completed at the house. I hated proving Mom right, but more often than not, I proved Mom right. "You can just come to mine," Niru said. He had never asked me to come home with him. My house was so much closer to school, and my parents were almost never around, so we had the run of the house most of the time. We sat at the kitchen table drinking juice and crashing through homework. Sometimes we watched YouTube clips on our phones. Nehru liked thug-life animals. That was the only thing that could reliably get him to break focus. When my parents came home, they treated Nehru with the politeness of functionaries used to meeting people they wouldn't remember but knew they would see again. He responded in kind, with a timid formality, never speaking unless spoken to, and then mostly in yes-sirs and yes-ma'ams before quickly slipping out the front door. I met his parents briefly after an orchestra concert, where they sat in the front row with their eyes intensely focused on Nehru and their arms folded tightly across their chests. His mother wore a loose blue Nigerian dress with elaborate gold embroidery along the cuffs and collar. His father wore a suit and tie. I didn't bother to search the audience for my own parents because I knew they wouldn't be there. After we finished, they congratulated us on playing as we stood together by the table of cookies, pastries, and plastic cups of sparkling water, sparkling cider, and juice. Nehru's mother's eyes were half closed behind her glasses. His father smiled at everyone, but generally kept his conversation short. "Your parents couldn't make it?" Nehru's mother asked when I followed them to their car after they offered to drop me at home. "Will there be anyone at home with you?" his father asked when we pulled up in front of my house. It was the only building without lights on. I could hear real concern in his voice. I liked him immediately, despite Nehru's tales of his strictness and intransigence. "Your parents pay attention," I whispered to Nehru. He shrugged. We walked back to his place from the canal, and I forgot my fatigue as soon as I saw the swimming pool in his backyard. I dashed to the wrought iron fence, swung through the gate, and catapulted myself towards the water. The cold made me gasp, but it felt good to have something wash away the film of sweat and salt from my skin. The chlorine stung my eyes and nose, and my running shoes grew heavy with water. I kicked the pool's edge and pulled myself up against the warm brick edging. Nehru's bare feet hopped on the hot pavement before my eyes. "You're crazy," he said. Then he jumped in. We chased each other around in the pool, despite our fatigue and dehydration. We splashed each other and took turns trying to see who could hold their breath for longer. We challenged each other to see who could lie for longer on the sun-heated bricks. "I don't have sunscreen," I said to him. "I don't need sunscreen," he said. We laughed and dripped from the patio to the basement bathrooms, where Nehru pulled large plush towels from the linen closet. We wrapped ourselves up to dry against the blasting cold from the central air. His house was immaculate, with thick carpets on the stairs and brightly polished wood floors and wood cabinets in an expansive kitchen. Piles of mail stood in neat stacks on a low kitchen counter next to small picture frames of his family in various places around the world. He scurried about nervously, adjusting this and that to make sure everything was in its place, sweeping a plate of uneaten toast into the sink, replacing an orange that had rolled off a stacked fruit bowl. I lifted lids from the two pots still on the burner. One contained rice, and the other a thick vegetable stew that smelled of fish. Nehru pounced and covered the pots. Then he lifted the stew and carried it to the stainless steel fridge. "Yo, I'm hungry," I said. "You wouldn't like that," Nehru said. "We can just order a pizza." "You have a very nice house," I said to his mother when she came home from work. "The artwork is beautiful." I ran my fingers over the embroidered tablecloth on the kitchen table. "This is very cool." Nehru's mother chuckled and smiled. "I like her. Where did you find this one?" she said to Nehru, who stood awkwardly by a small indoor tree, fiddling with its leaves. "On the path by the river," I said. "We went for a run earlier." People's parents always liked me. I knew how to charm adults. "Because I'm an only child," I told Nehru, "because I'm more sophisticated." I loved the political conversations that swirled around Mom and Dad's dinner parties. I would lodge myself at the top of the stairs when their friends stopped by and listen to them talk about their marriages and divorces and mortgages and second homes. "You must join us for dinner," Nehru's mom said as she retrieved pots and pans from her cabinets and vegetables from the fridge. She wore shiny red flats with her long, light blue skirt. She had a playful band of colored hearts on her right wrist. When Niru's father came home, we all sat at the kitchen table and ate large plates of jollof rice and plantain. I was hungry, so I dished myself a second helping, careful not to spill anything from the platter onto the deep purple tablecloth. His father was astonished. "It's not too spicy?" he asked. He removed his tie and rolled up his sleeves. His mustache held on to tiny drops of water from his glass. Niru shifted in his seat when his father asked me about my father and the president. He stroked his beard when I talked about the Oval Office and the White House grounds. Niru's mom offered me more water and asked if I wanted ice cream. I always wanted ice cream, so we ate dessert while the sun unraveled above the shifting trees in the backyard until Niru's father asked, "Do your parents know you are here?" His shirt tails had slipped out from his pants. I said no. "I don't have my phone," I said. Niru's father shot a glance across the kitchen.
"Nguanu, give her a phone so she can call her parents," he half shouted. "It's getting late. Niru can take you home."
I didn't say anything, but I didn't want to leave. How have I made it this far? When I stop, I feel the full force of my breathlessness. I know these streets, but I am unsure of how I arrived here. Each house on this tree-lined cul-de-sac stands as an island in a sea of impossibly green, impossibly level grass, except for one at the very end, where yellow dandelions pop up in random spots and clusters. I place my hands on my knees as I search for breath. My legs vibrate, and my joints throb from the run. I should turn around and go home, or find a shaded spot where I can sit and wait for an Uber, but my feet move me forward, slowly. There are watermarks and concentric parabolas on the white paint underneath the gutters, and the black paint on the shutters has faded and peeled. Blinds cover each window. From where I stand, I can see the front door is ajar. I freeze in place as a man emerges with his chin tucked to his chest. His unkempt hair is completely white and frizzes like a halo around his head. He walks a few hesitant steps to the Range Rover idling in the front drive, opens the door, and steps a foot inside while holding himself steady on the frame. Suddenly, he leaps out and dashes back to the house, then back to the car, which he finally backs slowly down the drive. It abruptly stops, and he dashes to the house again, fumbles at the lock, disappears inside, and closes the door behind him, leaving the car running. It sounds like it needs servicing. 6 years have passed, but I can still feel the police car vibrate beneath me. I feel things more than I see or hear because I don't want to see and I don't want to hear over and over the pop, 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 pop. Yes, four. His hands slapping the pavement, his horrible, rasping breath. I don't want to see that officer's shell-shocked but determined face. I feel so cold, then hot, and I feel someone's jacket on my shoulders and a wet towel wiping my mouth. I feel my fingers stick together with blood that is not my blood and stick to a phone that is not my phone, even though I hold it like it's my life. I feel the voices as they try to comfort me. They ask me if I'm hurt. They say an ambulance is on the way. They ask for identification, but my card says I am Amy from Maryland. They keep repeating Amy as if saying that name will make me feel less alone. But Niru is no longer with me, and I am very alone. This world is flashing red light and blue light and menacing silhouettes. I want to scream as they take me away from him. Instead, I close my eyes. Then I cannot open them fully because the light is too bright. It makes my head hurt, especially where Niru slammed me against the brick wall. I see people as blurred shapes swimming around in a shower of fluorescent light. I focus on voices and touch, slowly parsing this blip from that bleep, curtains sliding on aluminum rods, and footsteps from nurses whose sneakers squeak differently from physicians' clopping shoes. I hear different flavors of Caribbean accent, and think of my childhood nanny, Ms. Simpson, who always smelled of cinnamon and roses, who wiped my nose in a way that made me sneeze. I hear different flavors of African accents that Nehru's friendship has made easier to discern. Where is he? Where is he? I ask the various people who enter my pod. They respond with some version of the same platitudes. Everything will be okay. You're safe here. Before busying themselves with the cold compress against my forehead and the different machines and monitors around me. They say, get some rest. But when I lie back, I can't breathe. When I sit up, I can't think. My stomach fights against my lungs and my throat burns deep in my chest. There is a tube in my arm secured by white tape. My legs rest beneath a white hospital blanket. I have no shoes. If there were ever a time to cry, that time is now, but I can't figure out how. Where is he? I know one answer, that he is not behind the next curtain, a drunken shout away, and that means something very bad. It means I didn't get to say, don't close your eyes, please hold on, stay with me, as people who are close to people say in all the movies. It means I will never tell him how much I love him. I didn't know a person could bleed out so fast, but I never knew how fast people bleed when shot. I remember an Iraq war veteran who spoke to us at a school assembly. It's not like the movies, she said. She wore a black, form-fitting mini dress that revealed a titanium prosthetic attached to a muscular leg amputated just above her knee. I got hit in the back, too, she said, and turned around to reveal a mottled budge of scar tissue in the deep scoop of her backless dress. There is no describing that pain, she said. All you want is to close your eyes and have everything be over. A nurse says, this has been ringing. Her name tag reads Moyo, and she hums religious praise songs while she works, taking vitals, inserting lines. She holds up a clear plastic bag with a few accessories, my small black purse, my iPhone with a freshly splintered screen, and Nehru's black Nokia that sings Sati. I look at the screen. It says Daddy. I answer because the word makes me feel calm.
Who is this?
Meredith.
Oh, Meredith. Hi, how are you? Nehru's father says, trying to sound normal, but I can hear worry and rage inside his extreme calm.
I want to speak, but can't find words. My lips stay closed, sticky with my own dried saliva.
Meredith, are you there? Okay, good. Where is Nehru? Is he there with you?
I struggle with the sound of his voice as I push my brain to do the work necessary to open my lips to give the right response, any response.
Are you there? Okay, well, if he's there with you, tell him that we really need to speak with him.
His voice cracks, and I can resist no longer. I clutch at my hair with a free hand, forgetting the spot where my head hit the wall, and wince. Nurse Moyo catches the phone as it slips from my hand, ever ready, as if she's been through this moment 1,000 times before.
Sir, she says, your daughter is here in the GW emergency room.
She's in good hands, and she will be fine. I can't say much more, but it's better that you come. Her face crunches.
Your son? I don't know. Hello? Hello?
She looks at the phone for a moment and places it on the bed next to my legs. She says, he'll be here soon, I'm sure. I hug my knees to my chest and struggle to catch my breath. Then he is here, all of him so very present. He is not calm. He does not wear a suit. His navy blue golf shirt has large pink wounds from an encounter with the wrong kind of laundry detergent, and it is only half tucked into wrinkled khaki pants. They have already told him. I know because he can't breathe. He gasps for air as he stands supporting himself with one hand against the wall that flanks the bay where they placed me. I struggle to slide upwards against the angle of the bed and the pillow behind me. Nehru's father fluctuates in size and is sometimes more an abstract shape than an actual thing, and that is just fine. A clear view to his shattered face, patched and held together by sheer force of will, is too much in a situation that already surpasses superlatives.
What have I done?
I think. I clench my teeth and bunch the sheets in my hands. Meredith, he manages to say, before he slumps against the wall and crouches down to the floor. He starts to cry and pound the wall with his fist. I listen to him and try not to watch because it hurts to look at things for too long and because Nehru would have found this show of weakness unbecoming. What do you say to a grown man in tears? Dad cried when his candidate lost the election. That is understandable. All the tense hours, all the sleepless nights, the thought that such devotion nearly cost him his marriage. Mom held his hand, and I hugged him around the waist while we sat with a would-be senator that I wouldn't have voted for even if I had been able to vote. It's okay, Dad. There's always next time, I said. With death, there is no next time. It's all my fault, I say softly. If Nehru's father hears me, he gives no sign. His shoulders shake. He clutches the back of his neck. It's all my fault, I say, unsure what to do next. This is all my fault. When he finally turns to face me, with red eyes and a shining face, he asks, "Do your parents know you are here?" I shake my head no. "Well, I guess we'd better tell them," he says. But he doesn't move. Chapter 4. Sometimes I wonder if my parents like me. I know the laws of nature and genetic self-perpetuation demand that they love me, but it has never been clear that I am integral to their lives. They've had each other since Mom literally ran into Dad on the steps of the Harvard Law Library however many years ago when Dad was adding a JD to his PhD and Mom was starting her first year of law school. Dad wants to be a Supreme Court justice. That's why they moved to D.C., so he could clerk and then work at the Justice Department and eventually the White House, getting to know the people he needs to know to be the next big thing. It's why Mom has always worked in corporate America, because someone must pay the bills, and then some. I don't know that he'll ever make the court now. The politics have changed considerably, and he's not getting any younger. But also there's me and my baggage. In his most frustrated moments, my boyfriend says I think of myself too much. I don't disagree. I tell him that's what happens when you date a younger woman. And he is quiet. He says he doesn't get me, that I'm a mystery. Because I don't completely get me, I say. This current me is a young, wannabe photojournalist trying to start a career in a world inhospitable to photojournalists, the kind of woman who has made certain choices in support of my ambition without fully understanding the why behind my ambition, who is too proud to ask my parents for money, but not too proud to stay on their insurance or to cohabitate, temporarily, with a man 10 years older because I contribute in my own way, even if he pays the rent. And besides, Dad is 10 years older than Mom. I know Mom disapproves because she doesn't ask about my personal life. Everything about me now doesn't fit her image of the strong woman. She has never relied on anyone to support her existence. My life was supposed to be very different. Nehru and I were supposed to go to Harvard together. He was supposed to become a doctor, the cool kind, a trauma surgeon who saves lives in difficult places. I was supposed to become a lawyer, the cool kind, like Amal Clooney, who prevents genocides while wearing Louboutins. We were supposed to live in an apartment in New York, then a row house in DuPont Circle, and settle in Foxhall or Calorama with our beautiful biracial children, an older girl and younger boy. We would name them Nigerian names and use our one car to take them skiing in Vermont. But then I kissed him, and that loosely woven fantasy unraveled. Most of life since has been a mystery to me. Mom and Dad eat takeout salads in the kitchen. Dad stands at the island counter in dad jeans and a t-shirt, while Mom sits on the floor, her back against the fridge, legs stretched out in front of her, balancing a plastic plate on her lap. The biodegradable takeout bowl and two tall plastic cups of lemonade with mint leaves bunched inside rest on the countertop. Mom pushes kale leaves around her plate and watches the brown tail of balsamic dressing slide around the blue plastic. She spears a cherry tomato on her fork and brings it to her lips. "Can you believe we're leaving?" Dad says to no one in particular, but he looks at me. "We're really moving on." "Eat something, Meredith," Mom says from the floor. "You've been here how many days, and I don't think I've seen you put food in your mouth once. I mean, you can get something else if you're not interested." I use two black plastic forks to dish kale and chicken onto my plate. Dad squints because he can't see faces if he's not wearing his glasses. "This was such the perfect place," he says. "I remember when we first saw it, your mom, Texan that she is, thought it was way too small. Would have been, too, if we'd had more kids. Thank God we didn't," says Mom. "I guess I'm all you ever needed," I say. "All we could handle," Mom says. "Mom," I say. She sets her plate down and groans as she pushes herself into a standing position. "Sweetie," she says, "I'm just joking. Do you want some lemonade?" Now that we don't live together, she's much more affectionate than she used to be. "Sweetie" is a new thing. She pushes Dad's lemonade and a red plastic cup across the counter toward me. "I'm going to miss this kitchen," she says. "So much life has happened in this kitchen." For a second, I think she's going to cry, but she doesn't. "We've really got to get packing," she says, before she leaves the room. The balsamic dressing stings my lips. I slice into the chicken and watch its flesh separate around the plastic knife, releasing warm oils and a sweet smell that should be enticing, but my stomach is tight. Neeru and I spent the morning after he came out to me in this kitchen. We wore winter coats and wrapped ourselves in blankets, huddling together against the gas oven because the blizzard knocked out the power, and this was the only way to get some heat. It felt like the beginning of the end, and the zombies might throw themselves against the glass-paned kitchen door at any moment. I asked, "Does it feel real?" He said, "I feel numb. I feel scared." "So many people are gay, Neeru. It's not that big a deal," I said. "That's just a dumb thing to say. Nobody is watching you, Meredith. Nobody. Everybody is watching me." Then he laughed. I had to laugh, too, even if I hated him a little bit. Laughing made us warmer. "Now that we're leaving D.C., you'll visit us more?" Dad asks. He sighs as if there is more to say that he doesn't know how to say. "You know we're still your parents," he says. "Some things just don't change." Then he turns and follows Mom. But some things do change. Neeru's father has changed, and that is at least partly my fault. I have also changed. I'm older and more sensitive now. I know more of the world. Maybe that makes me a better person. Or maybe I just know more. The next day, I run back to Neeru's house. Perhaps it's foolishness that brings me back here to watch the sprinklers spray a fine mist on either side of the black asphalt drive. It's why the grass remains a lush green, even if no one tends to it. Sunlight bounces off the wet patches, and the years of car oil trapped inside shine in intermittent, distorted rainbows. I move towards the grit-streaked white columns at the front entrance and the old-style black lantern hanging beneath. Cobwebs stream from its rusted chain-link fasteners, and it has no bulbs inside. Neeru said his father liked the design because it reminded him of the White House. Now the luster is gone. There are three packages on the steps, alongside a stack of old newspapers melting into a pulpy mass from rain and age. The potted plants on either side of the door have died, and there is a forgotten coffee mug beside them filled with water and dead potato bugs. This place looks abandoned, but I know his father still lives here. When I woke up this morning, my course of action was abundantly clear. A small voice said, "You must go to him," and then nothing else. I bundled up Neeru's windbreaker and left the house before Mom and Dad woke up. Now I am here, my fingers suspended above the yellowed doorbell button. Stay or leave? That is the question. I look back at my tracks across the wet grass. The sprinklers chirp and whir relentlessly. 6 years ago, I come to apologize, because that is the only thing I know how to do. There are numerous cars on the street and crowding the drive as their passengers linger in the dimly lit windows alone and in pairs, heads bowed forward, movement slow. I can do this, I tell myself, as the sprinklers spit and the night fills with a chorus of cicadas and frogs. They have told me to stay home, stay quiet, stay out of sight, but this feels like the right thing to do, that something good will come from public supplication to the mourners inside. A slow, sad song muffles through the front door, off-key and yet still harmonized. I am still for a moment, as sadness washes over me. Then I press the doorbell. The light inside the plastic goes dark, then the noise, ding, but no dong. I feel for the written note in my pocket. I have practiced its words multiple times in the mirror. I wipe my forehead with the back of my hand. My sneakers are wet. I have crossed the Rubicon. OJ answers the door. I have never met him in person, but Nehru's stories and his pictures make him intensely familiar. There is no mistaking them for anything but brothers. Their eyes, their nostrils, their jaws follow similar curves, and they both favor the simple, sharp definitions of low-cut and freshly edged hair. He wears a simple white t-shirt, distinctly stained in the two spots where it has been used to wipe now red eyes. The space between his nose and upper lip glistens. His face is blank as he searches my face, and then he realizes who I am. He opens his mouth as if to speak, and his lips move, but no words come out. I step backwards, immediately forgetting the steps behind me, and unsure of my footing, I tumble down onto the wet pavement. Junior, I hear Nehru's father say, who is at the door? Before his body appears in the doorway. What the fuck are you coming here for? OJ shouts at me. Junior, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, his father says. I push myself up to my knees. I have skinned my palms and both of my wrists are sore from the unexpected impact. I massage my tailbone with a free hand. Rods of pain shoot down my spine and into my legs. Let go of me, OJ shouts as he pushes toward me. Let me go! I watch the two men struggle with each other, dark shadows silhouetted by the light behind. Nehru's father holds OJ in a bear hug and whispers something into his ear while he bucks. There is little besides interlocked fingers and soothing words that prevent OJ from moving towards me with his full force, and I swallow the blood trickling inside my cheek with a sense of relief. Still part of me wants him to break free, to hit me. OJ sounds like Nehru when he cries, a word here, a gasp there between soft moaning. Bodies fill the space behind them, dark figures crowding the doorway, jostling each other as they reach forward with quivering arms to pull them inside. Nehru's father shouts, Ify! As he steps toward them, with OJ slumped against him, crying into his chest, holding his hand away from his body like he is afraid of what else it might do. It's okay. Take him, please, Nehru's father says, pushing OJ towards the arms which quickly pull him in. Please, everybody, let's go back inside. It's okay, let's just go back inside. Close the door, please. His shirt is wet where OJ sobbed against him. He pulls me up. His hands are firm and his palms rough. This close, I can see he has new wrinkles in his face and brow. Why did you come here? He asks. I came to say I'm sorry, I say. You're sorry? Young lady, do you hear what they are saying about my son? You think your sorry will fix that? It wasn't like that, I say. He never would have done that. He didn't like girls like that. Let me tell them he wasn't like that. He doesn't say anything. The door opens, and a young boy peeks his head out. Uncle Obi, he says. Go back inside, Chidozie. Nehru's father says, waving him away with his hands. He presses his palms together, puts his fingertips to his lips, and steps back. Do your parents know you're here? He says after a long while. No? I'll call you a taxi, he says. You can wait out here. 6 years ago, I didn't know what I was doing.
why I showed up, or how I even got here. Now I can answer at least one of those questions. I wait and press the doorbell again. No response. I knock on the door, and it swings back from the seal. An alarm chimes sharply, startling me. Then the house falls silent. "Hello?" I shout inside. "Mr. Ikemadu? Hello?" I should turn back. I should leave this place immediately, but my feet sink into a soft entry rug as I step into what looks like the movie set of an abandoned home. My steps creak across the wood floors as I pass a sitting room and dining room where the little light streaming through the drawn curtains captures floating dust that settles atop a large wood dining table. In the kitchen, a lopsided stack of dirty plates near the sink is a breeding ground for a swarm of flies. Stagnant water rests in the basin, covered by an oily yellow film. The trash stinks from its bin beneath the sink. I try to breathe through my mouth, but the smell is overwhelming. It owns the room. The paint on the ceiling bubbles where a leak has gone unattended, and there are folded yellowed newspapers scattered across all surfaces, the place where mail once stood in stacks, the kitchen table where I once ate with Niru's family. I bring my hand to my mouth. This is what I have done. I stand at the sink and look out to a backyard of full green trees. Then I plunge my hands into the dirty water to search for the drain. It feels good to soak my hands in the filth, to root around for submerged cutlery, and finally scoop away the leavings that clog the sink. The drain greedily sucks down water, leaving a yellow film clinging to silverware and burnt-bottomed pots. I begin to wash the plates in hot water. When I am finished, I empty a spray can of air freshener, cough, and continue spraying until the scent of decay cowers under a nostril-widening lemon zest. We cleaned up the same way just before he drove me home that summer night. He was as efficient as a busboy in a restaurant, wiping the table with a damp cloth as he removed the placemats, as he handed me plates and saucers to scrape into the bin before ruthlessly rinsing them with the spray nozzle dangling from the faucet. "If school doesn't work out, you could always be a waiter," I smirked. I should leave before someone comes, but I keep going. I have no idea what I am doing or when Niru's father might return. I should really leave now, but I keep going. Niru never invited me upstairs, and despite having crossed the threshold of breaking and entering, it still feels sacrilegious to set foot on the carpeted steps that lead up and away from the kitchen. I remove my shoes and place them neatly to one side. I climb the steps between framed, faded pictures of people from another time in another country. There is a large black-and-white photo of a man and woman who can only be Niru's grandparents. They look uncomfortable in their fine Sunday clothes. Niru should be at rest now, hopefully at peace, permanently, beside their bones. The top floor is a madness of boxes and bags spilling from a hallway closet left half open to display a disorganized collection of bedsheets and towels. I hear the high whine and low voices of a television, so I move in that direction. The master bedroom pulses as images from a cable news program flash across a flat screen. The remote control sits on a nightstand near a cascade of crumpled tissues spilling onto half-finished plates of food on the floor near the bed. A framed picture of Niru as a toddler lies on the floor next to an empty prescription pill bottle. I have already crossed so many lines, but this violation feels absolute. In every faith, there is a part of the temple too sacred for all but the most faithful. I back out of the room and close the door. I have never been to Niru's room, but I have seen pictures on video chat, the trophies garnished with ribbons, a poster of Kendrick Lamar hung next to a bookshelf overfilled with science fiction novels and comics, a large goatskin drum tucked away in a corner next to his clarinet case. I stand at the threshold of his room and look at life suspended. I hesitate to move my feet from the white hallway carpet to the green carpet that covers the floor of his room. I can go no further. There is a line between decency and the real world. There was a line between me and him before I kissed him, before he pushed me against the wall, before the pop, 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 pop.
But you did not pull the trigger, Dr. Blake says. Repeat after me, I did not pull the trigger. She says, Meredith, I need you here with me now.
I did not pull the trigger, I say, if only because I like her buzzed white hair and large black glasses. She makes me feel safe, even if Mom and Dad forced me to see her. And breathe in, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, she says. And release, she says. It's driving me out of my mind, I tell her. All the time, everywhere, he's there watching me, waiting for me when I go to the bathroom in the night, when I turn a corner, when I'm sitting in the living room, when I run and I stretch, and he should be there in real life. I can feel him. I can feel his eyes on me. I can feel him angry.
What does it feel like to be watched? Dr. Blake says.
Oh my God, what the fuck? I want to scream at this doctor and her unending questions. What do you mean, what does it feel like? I'm scared, I say. I'm really, really scared.
You think he's coming for you?
Well, yes, I do. I'd come for me.
But I'm not a monster, the police officer on television says to the heavy-set black woman with voluminous curls. In the days after the shooting, it's all television can talk about, all the internet can tweet. Nehru and I are the subject of online laments and cable insult wars. The officer's eyes are afraid, and he shifts from side to side in his seat.
I saw what I saw. I saw a man attacking a young woman, and I took appropriate action.
She says, actually, this is a boy we are talking about, a teenager. A Harvard-bound black boy. She says witnesses saw her run after him, that he left the venue before her. He says,
I saw a young woman being assaulted, and I intervened to stop it using what the department has deemed appropriate force.
And you feel no remorse? A child is dead.
But I'm not a monster. I'm not a monster. I'm just a police officer and a former veteran trying to do my best to keep our streets safe.
There is the police chief on television, her blonde hair in a bun stretching her shiny forehead, flanked by the mayor and some other officials of clear importance but little significance, together in a small conference room arrayed against the cameras, the microphones, and the invisible public beyond. They brandish words like tolerance and calm as if they are truncheons. There is no joy in this for anyone, she says, and the officials nod their somber nods of affirmation. I am also not a monster, but he won't leave me alone. He's in my nightmares and in my daydreams. You need to let him go, Meredith. Dr. Blake says to me as I hide my face behind my hands and sink into the armchair in her office.
He needs to let me go, I say back as I hold myself and rock against the air. He needs to leave me alone, I say when I can suddenly feel his presence.
He comes to me in the shower, in the rising steam when I am naked, between the white tiles and sliding glass. Kiss me, I say, but he doesn't kiss me, and the hot water at our feet turns to blood, so I scream, get it off me, get it off me! And my parents come running with the things you say to people when you want them to be okay. The morning of graduation, I cannot get out of bed. The school has told me not to come, has told all the students not to say anything to anyone about what has happened. No one has called me. They all think I'm toxic or damaged or both. I cannot stop crying, so Dad holds me while Mom stands in the doorway with her half-open mouth and palms against her chest. Dad rocks me and whispers to me. He sings a little song in my ear as he dries my naked body with a towel while Mom stands in the doorway. He carries me to my bed, rests my head on his knees, and lets my tears and snot soak dark spots into his white trousers. He says, I love you. While Mom stands in the doorway. She blames me, I tell Dr. Blake, for fucking it all up for them. From day one, she blames me.
Breathe, Meredith, with me, too.
2, 3, 4, 5, Dr. Blake says. I tell her,
sometimes I can still feel him touching me. I can still feel his breath on my face and his face against my face. Sometimes I can feel hands and sometimes...
Sometimes? Meredith? Dr. Blake asks, as she always asks when I stop speaking.
Sometimes I wish...
What do you wish, Meredith?
Sometimes I think...
What do you think, Meredith?
I think this would be easier if...
Dr. Blake nods knowingly. It would be easier if he had raped you, she says. I look up like a cat caught knocking something valuable from a table. It's perfectly normal to have these thoughts, Dr. Blake says.
But I should have said something, I say. I should say something. I guess...
You guess, Meredith?
I guess...
Sometimes it's easier to be the victim, this woman says so matter-of-fact with her skinny jeans and her white blouse, and Mom and Dad nod like they agree. She is a PR crisis specialist sent by Mom and Dad's law school friend. I don't like her. There will be no social media, she says. You will not post, you will not message, you will not log into your accounts, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Google+. Then she smiles like her cheeks are connected to hooks set to a precisely calibrated timer. We will say nothing. If you feel like saying something, you will call me or you will text me. And Mom and Dad nod like they agree. Dad, Mom, I ask, but they don't say anything. Right now, at least 50% of America thinks you were assaulted. That's good. I mean, important. We can exhale a little. Their sympathies lie with you. From here, the best way forward is just not to say anything. And Mom and Dad don't say anything.
I'm not the victim, I shout. He is.
Meredith, Mom says, this isn't so simple. No one will...
It seems pretty simple to me.
Meredith, this stuff is too complicated for most people to...
What's so complicated about the fact that he didn't assault me? I pushed him.
You want to try to explain that to all those angry people out there? You think they...
Mom, I plead. The police shot him. He wasn't trying to rape me. Mom, I pushed him. It was just a fight.
Nobody here is saying he's a rapist, the woman cuts in. We're just not saying anything. We are trying to draw as little attention to you and your parents as possible. There is nothing wrong with saying nothing.
But they shot him, I say.
They shot him, yes. The woman says, let them deal with that. Mom massages her temples with her fingertips.
I shouldn't have pushed him.
I sniffle. Dad rubs my back. A phone rings and I jump. It is my phone. My phone is ringing. My mother. Nehru's dad could come home soon from wherever he is gone. I should leave. Chapter 5. Our house is empty now, except for the air mattresses we sleep on, and the miscellaneous items Mom has deemed too valuable to entrust even to bonded and insured movers. We stand in the kitchen with boxes of pizza and a bottle of wine. Mom and Dad flip a coin to see which one of them has to drive up. The other will fly to Boston to receive the truck. Mom loses. Dad says he has no problem driving, that Mom should take the flight to Boston and he will bring the car. No, I want to do it, Mom says. Their little protests are too cute and echo through rooms with bright lights that have nothing to illuminate. Meredith and I can take a little road trip. Right, sweetie? Her voice drifts from the kitchen through the house to find me. I don't respond because 5 hours in a car with Mom sounds like 4 hours too many. When we get to New York, she will want to see where I live. They don't know that I live with my boyfriend. They've known precious little about how I conduct myself since I left their house. I won't live with him for much longer. I'm moving to Portland, Oregon, or Austin, Texas, or maybe even Mexico City. At least one of those places is the first stop. I just haven't told anyone yet, especially not Mom and Dad, who think I will take the bus or train to visit them every so often.
Their laughter echoes through the house as they continue to flip the coin. With nothing of substance to absorb it, it bounces through these hollow rooms from wall to wall around me. There is no place I can't hear it. My skin prickles. I am overcome with hate. They are good people, for sure, and they have always been good to me, which makes my emotions all the more confusing. They would say that everything they do for me. They have paid for my educational pedigree. They will leave me an inheritance. If I want doors to open, they can open them for me. If I want assignments, the emails will come, willingly, because my father and my mother know people, and the people they know always help their own. My boyfriend doesn't understand my reluctance. "You're throwing away practical gold," he says. "Just take one meeting," he says. "Just ask your dad for one introduction. It won't kill you. That's how this is done." It won't kill me, but he will never know the true cost. "Mom, Dad, I'm going for a walk," I shout into the house. If they hear me above their laughter, they don't say a word. The humid night is heavy with an almost thunderstorm that rumbles somewhere far away while streetlights shine upon the stillness. I walk towards the Rose Recreational Center and the baseball diamond at the end of O Street. In the daytime, little leaguers chase balls and each other, and in the early evenings, packs of dogs chase balls and each other, but this late, it's just me. I round the bases before exiting on P Street, where I stop, tempted by the playground's shivering swings, but I'm not a kid anymore, even if some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. "Life provides a graceful arc for the fortunate," Ms. McConnell used to say to us in class when our discussions veered off the subject of literature and into the murky slush of real-world problems illuminated in the books we read. My life has certainly been fortunate, with the obvious exception, and even then I'm still alive. Most of its early stages are documented in leather-bound photo albums, now in boxes rumbling northwards for their ultimate destination beneath the glass surface of Mom and Dad's coffee table. Nobody looks at albums anymore. Now they are a novelty form of memory, a nod to the immutable past at a time when things are so awful that we seek solace in revisionist histories. I can't forget completely, no matter how hard I have tried. Sometimes it works for a while. Some days this city doesn't exist, Nehru doesn't exist, and I am just me, separate, functional, independent, and free. I feel like it's a betrayal to want many more of such days, and yet I want more. Ahead of me, DuPont Circle is a pulsing beacon of street lamps orbited by red car lights. Water flows across the lip of its gigantic limestone chalice fountain set in the middle of a large stone bowl. The after-work crowd sits at its edges, talking personal lives and politics, as they always have and always will. The rest bow their heads towards smartphones and tap furiously as they grumble and navigate towards the intersections and metro entrances. It all seems so very normal, like nothing ever happened here, and yet this place was center stage for one of the largest impromptu protests this city has ever seen, courtesy of me. Only I wasn't there. I've seen the pictures, though. Even years later, it's difficult to look at images of teenagers carrying placards with slogans like "White Lies Cost Black Lives" scrawled in Sharpie, or at pictures of the performance artists, naked, with iron collars and thick chains running from neck to neck, knowing that you played a major, if not definitive, role in this half-remembered drama. Now people have other things to worry about, like healthcare and jobs. We have always had other things to worry about. "But do you really want to live in a world so closed?" Ms. McConnell asked us in class when we read Invisible Man and nobody paid attention. I remember her red face as she held her place with the book closed around one finger. "No, seriously, you all want to sit here, laugh, and not pay attention because you think none of this applies to you. Wake up, you live in America," she said. "It's not the 60s anymore," Rowan said. Ms. McConnell stood in the middle of the room, red-faced, holding her book with one hand and her mouth with the other, holding her breath to regain some composure. Then she walked out of the classroom, and the door slammed behind her. I looked at Niru for a long time, but he didn't return my gaze. I looked around the room at my classmates for some sign of fear or shame, but they were all blanks. After a